SCP-001, A Portrait of Hell, Part 1. The SCP universe isn't shy about discussing various possibilities for the afterlife, the great unknown of human existence. Some SCPs feature it as an endless period of waiting or decaying, others feature alternate dimensions or realities, and of course there's always the classic state of non-existence. Hell is also certainly a concept, sometimes taken humorously, other times not so much, but the idea of a place of eternal fire and pain could definitely be a reality in this universe. A Portrait of Hell is certainly an odd SCP, being largely more of a tale than a scientific document, focused around one man and his ultimate fate. Let's take a look. It begins with some text written by the Foundation's administrator, which reads, "When I was a child, my father once told me that hell is other people. I didn't know what he meant, but some of the sense, the weight of it, settled its way upon me. He wasn't looking at me when he said it. He was drinking whiskey, blinds half drawn against the sun, staring at the wall amidst the whining of flies. He enjoyed saying things like that to me. He prided himself on not being the kind of man who'd beat a child. When we lowered him into the earth, I remembered something else. Sitting in his hideout, watching him do the work. The gleam in his eye and in his teeth. A bony white tombstone smile as he convinced himself that he was doing the right thing. That it was all necessary. The sun, a black orange on the horizon, taking with it certainty as it melted into the mountains and brought with it the death of the night. His gaze so sharply pressed, his mouth so opened wide. I could have reached out and watched that sunset melt inside my arms. I wonder, now, if the flies are still whining, crawling on his face beneath the broken flesh of the earth." SCP-001-108 is the corpse of O53 hanging within its office at Site-01, engulfed by a perpetually burning fire. The fire has thus far spread across the entire office and a large section of the administrative wing of Site-01, and continually incinerates all matter within an expanding radius around the corpse. The expansion of the fire is erratic and cannot be predicted. On average, it is expanded approximately 4 meters per day when undisturbed. The containment procedures note that it is currently uncontained and has thus far proven to be extremely resilient to circumscription. As the threat posed by the anomaly to Site-01 is severe, its containment is deemed an extremely high priority to the Overseer Council. We're then given some more text from the administrator, which reads, "Maybe hell is a place on Earth. Our actions cause it, after all. We are trapped within them, in cycles of karma or depravity, hoping for an exit we cannot attain. I did not know my mother, but she used to paint. A wall in our home was a great fresco, one she had made, of a soft and green country. The brush flecked blue and spotted white on the wall, and the light shone through thin gauze curtains. I would lean up to touch it, feel the chips of paint, and think of faces after faces, framed in golden stars. My brother came home one day, out of his mind, and took a knife to it. I watched, horrified, as he slashed and slashed and scratched at it, screaming, letting it out. All he had taken, from the war, from death upon death. The light shone through still, illuminating every imperfection, magnifying them. On and on and on. The pattern destroyed." The fire that exudes from the corpse burns perpetually, and although the objects the fire attaches to may decay or wither, they will remain largely intact and continue to serve as an endless fuel source. Once an object is engulfed by the fire, it cannot be extinguished, even if it is moved outside of the afflicted radius surrounding the corpse. Anything that touches an object burning as a result of the corpse will in of itself become a new point of ignition. Living creatures immolated by the fire, however, will not die, regardless of how severely they are burned. Attempts to extinguish them directly often lead to additional casualties through exposure. These individuals can, however, be killed through other means, a consequence that is often necessitated, or in some cases requested, by persons afflicted. It is unknown if termination is sufficient to alleviate their suffering. That's a pretty all-time SCP line right there. Direct observation of the corpse is complicated by the severity of the fire in its immediate proximity. Initial images seem to indicate the origin of the inferno was the corpse's open mouth and now empty eye sockets. This is currently impossible to verify. Some more cheerful words from the administrator. Perhaps hell is a state, a condition. I have read the words of theologians, moderns, clutching their rosaries and staring up into their divine, their hopes and wishes, begging God for mercy. Annus Dei, qui tollis peccata mundi, miserere nobis. I met a monk from Salamanca praying in the tabernas. I was young then and full of arrogance. I was tracking a thing of light and shade, and I succeeded. The monk did not understand it, its vastness, its looming claws, its jagged tooth. He quavered, and his words spilled out like liquid, no matter what I tried. I saw the looks on his brothers' faces as I threw his body on their doorstep. They were trying to understand how the tangle of meat and limbs was their friend, their quiet companion. I felt, irrationally, a superiority. My flesh and my blood was not bread and wine. I had felt the sweat of light, the frost of shade. I knew things there were no words for. The corpse was discovered directly following 053 taking his own life. Immediately following termination of life signs, the administrator was automatically alerted to the failure of procedure Rashomon. MTF Alpha 1 were deployed to 053's office, where the corpse was discovered hanging from the roof, beginning to burn. Initial attempts to fight the fire emanating from the corpse only led to the spread of flames, including to the now inaccessible administrative wing infirmary. A majority of the individuals who initially attempted to contain the fire remain within the infirmary, unable to move, inaccessible to personnel or equipment that would be capable of terminating them. Based on the number of voices that were able to be identified, it is believed that there are 26 persons perpetually burning within the infirmary. Another note from the administrator. A Buddhist hell is a temporary place, a place you dwell in until your past life's sins are purged. But that's not the hell I was raised with. The image before my eyes emerges from a wooden church, its beams and whitewashed cloth narrowed to the point of the preacher's spittle and raised book. A Calvinist hell, a frozen place of burnt fire, torment unending. What a relief, is all I think. At last, you are ended. Every aspiration, every hope, every misery, useless and fruitless in the face of pain. Hell is a mercy in the end. No more thought is required. No more striving, no more guilt or fascination. There is just you and the pain. That I could wrap my arms around. That I could grapple with. I look into the fire and I hope By God, I hope for an ending. Persons exposed to the fires invariably become affected by hallucinations and visions as they begin to burn. These hallucinations seemingly follow several narratives. While the visions remain consistent across exposures, ascertaining the entire scope of the narrative has been difficult due to affected persons becoming overwhelmed by the fires and no longer being able or willing to communicate what they are seeing to staff researchers. In spite of this, enough of these hallucinations have been documented to construct three distinct narratives. Before we continue, we're given one more note, this time being written by 053 just prior to taking his life. It reads, "The administrator is a fool. He doesn't know hell at all. He couldn't if he tried." We then are provided three separate acts to this story, starting with Act 1, The Trail for Beasts. Since these are largely more akin to tales, I'll be reading large parts of these verbatim, though I will attempt to fold dialogue into the narration. The office smelled like new paint and fresh laminate. It had belonged to a previous site director and another director before them, stretching back to when they laid down the concrete pad the original building once sat on. That building, like so many other systems within the foundation, was now buried underneath a growing network of structures and bureaucracies that stretched out around it, the epicenter of a web spun by a great, invisible spider. Here, at its heart, Yoshihide could see every twist and tangle, every humming thread, each unknowing participant walking across the latticework. He wondered if the last director had seen him as well, slowly working his way inwards towards this office. The last director had, like many other directors, left suddenly when a new appointment was selected for them. Yoshihide remembered a time early in his career when a fellow researcher, one several years his senior, had cautioned him about the nature of careers in the Foundation. "Don't get thinking you have any say in the matter," he had said, a smoldering cigarette clutched in his fingers. "The Foundation offers you opportunities like you'd never believe, but the choice you have is an illusion. They'll put you where they want to put you, and make you think it was your idea. You get to think you're the master of your own destiny, but they will get what they want. In the end, they win either way." He couldn't help but feel, though, that he'd somehow broken the mold. The bookshelves, the desk, the engraved nameplate on the door. Akutagawa Yoshihide, site director. The trappings of success, certainly, but all of them every bit his own. He was a containment specialist. The best containment specialist, he often heard his peers say. And this was his reward for that talent. In this site were teams of doctors, researchers, clerks, all of them answering to him directly. There was no longer a medium he needed to answer through, no more taskmasters who had to be compelled to action. Sure, there were faceless directors and overseers above him somewhere, but as he'd climbed up the ladder to this office, those names had become less and less tangible and further away. He reported to someone somewhere, but did it matter? If you never saw them, did they even exist? This rise hadn't come without sacrifice. Choices he had been forced to make to reach the room he now sat in. He'd felt a keen sense of camaraderie with his co-workers at the beginning. Assistants and junior researchers who had all come up in the Foundation around the same time as he. Back then, the world had seemed so much bigger than it was now, and that companionship had been a life raft on a wild and uncertain sea. Over time, his work had filled more of the space where those friendships had lived, until one day he woke up and realized they were all gone. Yoshihide didn't mind it, though. the cost of his success, he reasoned. If the worst of it was losing a few drinking buddies, then that wasn't the end of the world. There had been other costs, though, greater and lesser. He had been away when his father had died, at a conference about staff reorganization. They had never been close, but as he'd gotten older, his old man had begun opening up more and more to Yoshihide. "Making up for lost time, if you'll let me," he used to say through a crooked smile and missing teeth. They had shared a few moments years before, after his mother died. He had always intended to go see him before the end, but those meetings seemed so important at the time. "This will look very good to senior leadership," an executive personnel manager had told him, so he went. When he got the call from the hospital that his father had passed, he had his affairs managed remotely to avoid having to leave the conference. He didn't have the heart to ask the nurse if his father had died alone. He knew the answer. The worst, though, had happened long before he had ever walked into his new office. She was an agent assigned to the local branch of the Global Occult Coalition when Yoshihide had been stationed in a little research site outside of Okazaki. He was taken by her immediately. She was clever, funny, sharp. Her eyes were cutting. He used to say that there was nothing he could hide from her that she couldn't just see through. Her laughter was a song and her touch a warm breeze in summer. When they were together, Yoshihide made excuses to get away from work, something unthinkable now, so they could spend the afternoons together. They had plans to get a place in the city, to start a family. Plans that didn't include the foundation. When their daughter was born, Yoshihide thought he might have finally found something that filled the hole in his heart. Then she was killed, of all things in a car accident, and Yoshihide was alone again. In the days and weeks that followed her funeral, he convinced himself there was no deeper pit of despair a man could suffer, no lower agony. Eventually, he threw himself back into his work, a welcome reprieve from his despair that helped to silence the screaming he heard when he closed his eyes at night. He took his daughter, only a child at the time, and moved to Europe. He found the pathway to promotion ready and available, and seized after it. At no point had he ever noticed the strings pulling at him, or the hands on the marionette. He was too busy looking forward to ever look up. So no, he thought, that old researcher had been wrong. The Foundation had opened doors for him, undoubtedly, but he was the one who chose which to walk through. It had been his own efforts that put his name on the door, and it would be by his own hand that he climbed to even higher offices than this. His meditations were disrupted by a knock on the door. A secretary, he hadn't learned their names yet, poked her head into the office. She informed him that there was a visitor here for him, with O5 clearance. Yoshihide sat up straight in his chair. This wouldn't be his first encounter with an O5 liaison, and he knew enough to never let your guard down around these people. Liaisons were vipers, persons who had abandoned all career ambition in order to offer total subservience to a single person. In doing so, they were allotted authority beyond their station, but at the cost of their agency. They made his skin crawl. The figure who passed through his door, though, was not a liaison at all. In fact, it wasn't anyone he'd ever seen before. It was a man, relatively tall but otherwise nondescript, in a sharp black suit with matching tie over a white shirt. Behind his dark glasses, Yoshihide could just barely make out his eyes, keen and aware, like a raptor. Something about him felt queer. The man greeted him with a wide grin and an extended hand. His voice was rich and genial, and Yoshihide was caught off guard by it. He welcomed him to his new station and apologized for his delay in getting here. He wanted to come offer his congratulations before he'd broken the place in, but it couldn't be helped with business being as it is. Yoshihide took his hand. It was firm and abrupt, but not inconsiderate. He tells the man that he appreciates the consideration, but has to beg his apology, as he doesn't believe they've met. The man helped himself into a chair opposite Yoshihide's desk, and the director followed suit. He paused for a moment, surveying the room. The man apologized and says that he likes to try and get out ahead of these things and make inroads as early as he can. Their working relationship is of paramount importance, but his schedule has gotten the better of him again. He tapped the side of his chin with an extended finger. He then states that he is the administrator, a go-between for directors and overseers, the grease that keeps the wheels moving. He's here to help facilitate Yoshihide's transition to this new post, as well as make sure his interactions with their esteemed O5 council are as seamless as possible. Yoshihide instinctively raised an eyebrow and remarked that he didn't know such a position existed. The man's smile didn't move an inch. Yoshihide could feel the hair on the back of his arms standing on end. The administrator stated that he's been at this for some time now, and his job here, aside from ferrying tidings of goodwill down from Overwatch Command, is to ensure a sort of linearity in their ideals. The staff of the Foundation, the researchers and task forces, they have their own goals and objectives. There are too many of them to address individually, so they rely on the site directors to maintain the sense of direction. Once you get to this level, there's an expectation of synchronicity. The overseers set the line. The directors are expected to stay within it, and he helps to make sure everyone knows where the line is. It is a narrow path, but it's one they all march together. They are, after all, here for the same reason. Yoshihide's brow furrowed, and he asked what reason would he say that is. The administrator placed his hands on the edge of Yoshihide's desk and leaned forward slightly. Containment, he said. They are the keepers of the box. There are things in this world that simply should not be. Were they gods, it would be enough to simply make them vanish, as if they were never there at all. There are some in their ranks who would seek to do just that, to use the mechanisms of man to accomplish a task ordained for God alone. They fail, of course, every one of them, as they are not gods. So they must do what they can while they wait for God to act. The irregularities in their world, the things that go bump in the night, they put them into boxes, and then they watch the boxes. They do not discriminate. They've learned too many hard lessons to know how badly that can go. If they do this, they achieve their goal. It is thankless and never-ending, but it is important, and it is right. A bead of sweat began to run down Yoshihide's back. He knew the administrator could not see it, but it did not change the fact that he felt as if the man somehow knew it was there all the same. He straightened up and nodded curtly, saying, "That is the work, after all." The administrator sat back in his chair. His smile softened somewhat, but not in a reassuring way. He said that he's glad to hear it, as his job and Yoshihide's become so much simpler when they have a good sense of synergy. He laughed and said that he hopes he'll forgive his corporatism. Old habits die hard. The truth of the matter remains. If he continues to illuminate the path, and Yoshihide stays on the path, and his subordinates follow his direction, then they will be a successful unit. He looked down at his watch and commented on the time. He apologized for departing as quickly as he arrived, as his schedule is a fickle puppeteer, and he is just another marionette dancing at the end of a rope. He stood, and Yoshihide followed suit. The administrator extended a hand, and Yoshihide shook it. The hand was strangely warm. He stated that they'll be in touch as he settles into his new role. He is excited to see him rise to this new challenge. He turned to leave, but as he opened the door, he stopped and turned back over his shoulder. He told Yoshihide not to forget that containment is their ultimate purpose, at whatever cost. Yoshihide said nothing, but nodded slightly. The administrator grinned, and then closed the door behind him as he left. Later, Yoshihide is speaking to his daughter, scolding her for not telling him that she was going to be in the city this month, a scowl desperately trying to mask his happiness at seeing her face. She laughed as she idly poked at her lunch, and remarked that you'd think after all his hard work to be a director, he could stand to finally relax a little bit. He sighed and said that that's how they get you. You dream of freedom, but each new rung on the ladder is another shackle. More responsibilities, more meetings, more phone calls. It never ends. Even now, he has had to block out a whole hour to spend time with his inconsiderate daughter. She turned up her nose and jabbed at him with a fork, telling him that here she thought she was doing him a favor, getting him out of that stuffy office. If he stays there too long, he's going to end up pickled, or worse. Yoshihide snickered and said that pickling might not be the worst outcome. It would do wonders for his skin. He paused for a moment, taking her in. She was every bit the picture of her mother, a blessing, considering the alternative. Her laughter was music and her presence was light. When she was with him, he could almost forget about the burden of his work, the time spent endlessly poring over notes and reports and files. Those thoughts consumed him, but whenever she was near, she seemed to so easily cast them away. She was clever as well. Almost too clever. While he could not help himself but feel pride in her when the Foundation had come calling for her expertise in exotic, high-tension meta-materials, it was cocooned in stifling, suffocating dread. It must have shown on his face, and she frowned. She asked him what's wrong, and if he was having indigestion. He wanted to laugh, but the moment was lost on him. He told her that he was fine. He just worries about her is all. She needs to let him know if she's ever in trouble, as he can help her out. More now than he's ever been able to before. She snorted and replied that she has a great job, a comfortable home. She gets to work on some of the most fascinating projects she's ever seen in her life, and her father is only a couple hours train ride away, when he can find time. This time he laughed, but only a little. She asked him what he's worried about, and he closed his eyes. He saw another pair looking back at him from behind dark glasses. He told her that she needs to stay aware, all the time. This is dangerous work they do, and there are always people watching, waiting to take advantage of them in their moments of weakness. She popped a grape in her mouth and spoke while she chewed, telling him that she has a hard time imagining someone starting trouble with the daughter of a site director, even if she is inconsiderate. He heard her mother's voice again, in her words. They were so similar. He said that it's not just about starting trouble, it's just about being aware. She needs to promise him, if she sees anything suspicious, or hears of anything that makes her uncomfortable, she'll let him know. She rolled her eyes and agreed, if it helps him sleep better at night. The last thing she needs is for him to keel over dead now from the stress. He relaxed for a moment, until he looked at her hands. She had picked up her fork and held the tines between her thumb and middle finger. With a firm but gentle motion, she pushed against the metal, and the metal danced under the pressure of her fingertips. It spread out, connecting with the other tines until they were a solid piece, and then she pushed into it with her thumb. The metal bent backwards like it was soft clay. When she released it, she was holding a spoon. His eyes darted to meet hers, but she was looking across the restaurant, hardly paying attention at all. Panic gripped him in an instant. His hand darted across the table and grabbed the spoon out of her hand, stashing it in his jacket pocket as quickly as he could. She jumped back in alarm, her other hand trying to slap his away. She shouted at him that she's not finished with her food, but he hissed at her to be quiet as he frantically scanned around the room. What has he told her about doing that, and out in the open like this? She blinked twice, stunned at his sudden turn, and asked what he's so worried about. It's just a fork, and there's nobody around to see it. Yoshihide replied that it's not just a fork. It never is, and don't for a second think that there aren't always people watching. Even if they're not watching her right now, they will be soon. She grabbed a spoon from his side of the table and glared at him, telling him that he worries too much. Nobody cares about a fork or a spoon. It's helpful to her, but it's not important. His voice quivering, he tells her that she needs to make another promise to him, that she'll never do this again. Now, more than ever, it is important that nobody knows what she's capable of. Her stare could have cut him to his core, just like her mother. She asked if he's worried them finding out she can change things will disrupt his career progression. Is she that much of an embarrassment to him? His heart broke. He saw her as a child, taking a little brass monkey and turning it into a snake, and then back again. She laughed and looked at him for approval. He had smiled. Why had he smiled? He had to have known better then. Why hadn't he done something sooner? He straightened himself and looked across the table at her. She seemed about to speak, but the indignation caught in her mouth. He simply said that she needs to promise him that she will give that up forever. It isn't about him. It's about her safety. She may feel comfortable now, and she may very well be safe now, but all it takes is the wrong person noticing or saying something to someone else. The only way she can be safe is if they have no reason to suspect she is capable of anything other than the great work she does. He loves her, and he wants her to be safe. He will continue to work to keep her safe, even if he must climb all the way to Overwatch Command to do it. But he needs her help. She held still for a moment, as if determining whether or not she wanted to lash out at him again. Then the moment passed, and she relaxed. She smiled a little smile and reached across to take his hand. He hadn't realized it was shaking until just then. She said, "Don't worry. Everything will be all right. She'll be all right." Blood coated his hand as he felt hers go cold. Even as she lay dying in the dim light of the headlamps, her eyes saw straight into his soul. She smiled a little smile. "Everything will be all right. I'll be all right. Don't worry." Months passed. The days, if they ever had a notion of individuality before, abandoned it entirely now as they blurred together in a ceaseless barrage of new tasks and obligations. He would, at times, laugh at the naivety of his youth, when he had imagined himself rising to the level of site director to have his pick of great and important projects to work on. He had been among the best containment specialists when he was younger. The best, some had claimed, and he knew it every bit as well as they did. He saw intricacies and subtleties that the others missed, and knew how to exploit them. He was occasionally able to convince himself that his rise to the chair he sat in now had been for noble reasons, but deep down he knew the truth. Containment was what he did well. But now his time was filled with endless approvals and reviews, inspection and training. Periodically, he would have moments where he was asked his thoughts on a new process, or had a chance to investigate a problem that was troubling his subordinates. Through it all, he began to feel a terrible, gripping thing. This was not the work he should be doing. Pushing papers and sorting files was administrative work. Surely the Foundation had people who could do that. The chair he sat in, the office, the desk. What was it, actually? Was it a position for him to exert influence? Was it a means by which to change the world? Was it a cage? So it was that a mere 3 years into his residency as a site director, Yoshihide found himself requested to fly out to a place he knew nothing about, at the behest of the overseers. He studied this location as much as he could, but all he gathered was that it was a small, unimportant house deep in the forests of Eastern Europe. Yet the overseers would not have called on him for something so meager. There had to be something there that required someone like him. A task that needed his keen intellect and judicious hand. Actual work, he thought. He left within the day. It was, as he had presumed, not much more than a tiny wooden house in the middle of the forest. It sat in a small clearing at the end of a long, narrow drive. The clearing was cleared, and a small stack of firewood sat outside the door of the house. The trees stretched tall in all directions around it, and in the dying light of day, he almost felt like they were bending in above him, choking off what little of the sun was left, before opening up to a deeper darkness. There was a light on inside, and smoke from a chimney. He entered the house. It was modestly furnished. Wooden furniture, woolen rug, pictures hung on the walls. The most striking thing, aside from the person sitting across from the doorway near the fire, were the many taxidermied heads of animals that filled every other possible inch of wall space that was not treasured family heirloom or window. Not just taxidermies, either. Skulls, in many cases. Some he had never seen before. The animals themselves, whatever was left of them, were strange. Eerily magnificent. Deer, elk, ram, wolf, and then skulls and skins of things he could not name. They stared out with glassy black eyes. Not at him. Not at anything. Then, of course, was the administrator. Yoshihide had almost forgotten his face from their meeting years before, though his words had never been too distant. He was looking into the fire, his hands folded neatly in his lap. He did not speak as Yoshihide entered, but gestured to another chair beside him. The scene was so bizarre, Yoshihide's mind was too busy racing to realize his body was acknowledging the courtesy and sitting down. "I realize my offer may have left you with expectations that are not currently being met," the administrator said. His voice was soft. Not nearly so bright and genial as it had been that day in his office. He apologized for any discourtesy, as he had only meant to not raise the concerns of anyone who might intercept the message. This place is, by his own design, not a place that one can be so easily followed to. Yoshihide moved to speak, but the words were absent. He had questions. Endless questions and growing concerns, but something in his better nature held his tongue. He distinctly had the feeling as if he was in the presence of something very dangerous and needed to be very careful. A few moments later, the administrator continued. "He has been watching his work for some time. He has risen to the challenge of his station, and his staff are dutiful in their fulfillment of the goals of the Foundation. He has no reason to feel anything but satisfaction in his selection to this position. He felt the other man looking at him now. He dared not look back. And yet, the administrator said, he cannot help but feel as if he is not reaching his full potential. He doesn't mean that as a criticism, as the limits of his office are such that perhaps he is not in the position to best carry out the work at which he is the most capable. He then asked if Yoshihide would agree with that. It was a trap. Yoshihide knew it. He saw the snare and felt the tension humming on the line. But the gnawing inside him suddenly flared, and he saw a long life lived sitting behind that desk, mindlessly rubber-stamping the better work of better men. He was good at what he did. The best, some had claimed. The gnawing consumed his growing apprehension. "Yes," he said quietly. The administrator smiled again and said that that's what he thought. He told Yoshihide to come with him and to grab a jacket if he has one. The forest around them was still. The energy of distant cities and all the lights of mankind were foreign to a place like this. None of the noise permeated the tall trees and the dense growth below them. The path they walked on was well maintained, though, and the only sound at all was the soft padding of their shoes on dirt. The administrator carried a lantern, an antique, if you can believe it, he'd said with a laugh. The light was sufficient to see their path, but little beyond it. The forest was everything. The administrator continued, saying that his grandfather always said, "Hell is the dark." He hated these woods, hated the things in them, hated the dark. He was paralyzed by the fear of it. This lantern was his, back when the house was as well. He paused for a moment at a large tree. He ran his hand across its surface. The bark was broken. Something had been by here. An animal, maybe. Something with antlers that had brushed against it. He continued. His grandfather only came out here when he needed food for his family. He would hunt, though he loathed it. The best hunting was at dusk, and if he was out too late, then there was the dark. Yoshihide asked why he lived in a place like this then, as surely he could have had somewhere closer to a town. He couldn't see his face, but he knew the administrator was smiling. He said that he asked himself the same question, but men are drawn to their antithesis, he thinks. They find comfort in believing that they are exposing themselves to something frightful. It makes them feel strong. His father had said that hell is dying. He didn't mind the dark, embraced it, actually. He was a hunter because he liked it. He enjoyed the chase, enjoyed pitting his wit against the instincts of a beast. He would come home from a hunt, successful or not, with such a look on his face. He's been gone for many years, but the administrator can still see his expression. It was rapture. He thinks he found religion in these woods. He halted, gathering his thoughts, and turned to Yoshihide. His father realized what he and Yoshihide both know. The chase is thrilling, no doubt, but the joy is in winning. It's not enough to just follow the beast, as a beast can follow a beast. To be able to have the life of something in your hands is something altogether different. That was his work. When the administrator was very young, he remembers being in town with his father when a woman came screaming into the square. Her child had gotten lost in the woods, and some manner of creature had found them. A jackal, maybe, or a wildcat, maybe even a great boar. Whatever it was, The child had only just survived the encounter. The thing had chewed off most of the face and much of the skin on the arms raised to defend itself. The soft meat, though he supposes at that age that most of the meat is soft. They had managed to escape and run, and by luck had blindly found their way back to their own home. The thing that came out of the forest was not her child anymore. Not really. It had been changed by the beast. It was a heaving, wretched thing. One ruined eye staring out in horror from behind a face that was little more than strips of meat clinging desperately to shattered bone. A mouth that would have screamed if it was not full of blood. A miserable thing. They carried on in silence for a while longer. After a time, the administrator paused and knelt down. He picked up something from the path below them. A tooth, something servid. He put it in his pocket. He said that his father carved this trail after that child was attacked. It stretches far and wide across these woods. He spent days, months, years studying how the creatures in this forest move throughout it. From his hunting posts, he watched them, and he noted their behavior. He kept extensive records. Truthfully, it was how they spent most of their time together growing up. Together, in silence, up in a tree, watching the beasts move. He held out his hand and moved it around, as if tracing something in his mind. They were blameless, of course. Beasts are just beasts. They can't reason the same way humans can. They aren't evil, but they are dangerous. One of them got a hold of that child, just one, and changed its life forever. He remembers seeing it years later, no longer a child, but a ghastly, haunted thing. They died young, as he remembers, but lived long enough to know true agony. Not just the pain of their injuries, though he's certain it was severe. No, he believes the greatest pain they felt was the loneliness that followed. They were horrible to look at, and were avoided by neighbors, friends, family. The beast did kill them in the end, but the dying was not the worst of it. Death is not hell. They came to a fork in the path. The administrator lifted his lantern again, looking in both directions. His father cut this path, finding that they tended to follow on the edge of cleared spaces, and he would follow these trails to wherever they would lead. In his mind, his father had always intended to just shepherd them away from the town, somewhere deeper into the forest. But this trail is just a box without a lid. It is not enough to put them in a cage if the cage has no door. They turned left at the fork and continued forward. One night, his father was maintaining this trail, and a bear found him. He wonders sometimes if, in his father's last moments, he greeted simply delaying what had suddenly become inevitable for him. It was not as if he didn't enjoy hunting. Maybe he thought this simply was not sporting. He doubts the bear cared either way. The administrator let out a sigh, pausing briefly, and asked if Yoshihide understands now. They are all the children of their fathers. He learned from his father, who learned from his before him. All of them flawed men. His father had vision, but lacked execution. He cut this trail for beasts, knowing they would get caught in it, but did not live long enough to realize for himself the true fulfillment of that vision. That's what they are. They are that fulfillment. They came to a clearing. In the dark, he saw nothing but felt something moving in the space in front of them. Something writhing. Something foul. The administrator lifted his lantern, and Yoshihide gasped. The administrator finished his statement by saying that this is the lid on the box. A mountain of corpses. Some old, some new, some still wriggling in agony from their butchery, desperately clinging to the meager life remaining in them. All of them stacked together in a groaning, heaving pile. Eyes that stared out at nothing. Beasts of all shapes and sizes, but not just beasts. Men as well. White jackets stained with blood that soaked into the groundwater. Some of them gunned down, perhaps. Others cut apart by cruel instruments. A tower of torment and despair, of misery that could not be understood. And across the entire forest, not a single sound to be heard. In the end, they are just problem solvers, the administrator said. His voice felt very far away, and every bit of the geniality of their first encounter had long fled. The problem is that the world is sick. For his father, for this town, it was beasts. Beasts that can devour a mother foraging for food. Beasts that can bite and poison you until you long for a quicker death than you are afforded. Beasts that tear the soft meat off a child's bones. For them, however, the beasts are more insidious. They are not always beasts they can see. But they are careful, and they are patient. They have cut their own path in the woods. They lead them to the clearing, and then they solve the problem. He lowered the lantern, and the light cast over the high grave retreated. There have been others like Yoshihide, and like him. Those who could not handle this knowledge. Presented with the scope of what they must do, that they would quake and quiver, and beg to return to their meager lives of tepid normalcy. They were a problem, too, in their own way. Yoshihide is very good at what he does. There is no questioning that he is competent. What he wants to know is whether he is capable. His voice was barely a whisper now. This is how they keep the world safe. They complete the work of their fathers. They were men of limited vision, but they are not. They will preserve the world. That is their work. He was suddenly in front of Yoshihide. His voice was a mask, and behind it was something with intention. Yoshihide felt his skin go cold. They cannot make exceptions, he said softly. Exceptions lead to pain and horror. A rabid dog must still be put down, regardless of whether or not it once came when you called. They do not have the luxury to choose. They can only perform the task in front of them. He paused, considering the director. He asked him once if he was prepared to do the work, and Yoshihide had said that he was. He has performed his task. Now, look at what they must do. See what is required for them to keep this world safe. He asks again, is he prepared to do the work? Yoshihide felt the panic rising inside him again. His heartbeat quickened. His vision began to swim and shimmer, but something else now rose within him to accompany the anxiety. He would have felt sick, but this new sensation overwhelmed all else. The fear slipped away, and then he thought of nothing but the desk, and the papers, and the chair. Despite himself, he was lost in his own grim desire. Yes, he said. He had never meant anything more in his life. The administrator bid them to go back then, as he has something he needs him to do. They turned back down the trail. If Yoshihide had been aware of anything other than the sea of thoughts he was lost in, he may have noticed the administrator staring at him from behind. His skin may have prickled at the malice radiating off of him. He might have felt the tension in the line. We already know how this ends, with Yoshihide's endlessly burning body hanging in Site 01. But as usual, it's about the journey, not the destination. The administrator sure seems to be taking a special interest in him, and since we know he ends up as one of the O5, he's likely going to continue taking an interest in him. We'll find out how exactly Yoshihide ended up in his present condition in Part 2.